The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. Since the publication of the first volume of his massive novel, Mein Kampf, or My Struggle, in 2009, Karl Ove Knausgård has become a household name in his native Norway and a loved and hated literary figure around the world. Thanks to that book, which totals 6 volumes, plus another 4-volume work titled After the Four Seasons, Knausgård has drawn comparisons ranging from Marcel Proust to a blogger on steroids. For some, he is the avatar of a new kind of writing or a new kind of novel, a pioneer who has advanced the novel into territory perfectly suited for the 21st century. For others, he is a hack, a charlatan, a navel-gazing fraud who barely deserves the title of novelist, let alone the acclaim or esteem that many have accorded him. What do we make of Karl Ove Knausgård? Why should we give his books our time? What's the best way to read him? And can we strip away the Sturm und Drang surrounding his books and see them with any kind of clarity? Luckily, we at the History of Literature podcast have a great reader of Knausgård, our old friend Mike Palindrome, who's here today to help us sort through one of the most polarizing figures in contemporary world literature. Karl Ove Knausgård with Mike Palindrome today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're here to join us. I'm fresh off my annual Burns Supper. Sometime I'm going to have to do an episode on Rabbi Burns, and maybe on Burns Night and the Burns Suppers. They remind me a little of Rilke in his poem, Torso of an Archaic Apollo, with its great finishing line, "You must change your life." Burns Night does that for me. I must change my life. I know it. I know I must do it. I feel the piercing beauty of the statue telling me it is so, just as I feel the condemnation of Rabbi Burns leading by example in his poetry, not his personal life, and maybe not even in his poetry, but the themes of his poetry, the themes, the call to arms, the longing for humans to be better, to be brothers and sisters, to connect, to elevate the simple to something fundamentally good, to avoid cynicism. Well, I'm stepping all over the future episode on Rabbi Burns now, but I will say, eating some haggis, the great chieftain of the pudding race, or some vegetarian haggis, which I kind of prefer. One of my companions at Burns Night, at the Burns Supper last night, a young lad of, 8 or 9, confided in me, "Did you know there are ingredients in haggis that are illegal to buy in America?" Ah, yes. Some things are better left unspoken, dear boy. Where were we? Karl Ove Knausgård today, born in 1968. He's 51 now, looking like a haggard Bjorn Borg, writing like a cross between Balzac and Samuel Pepys. What a sharp break he is with the history of literature. There's a general course, then there's him, and we don't really know what to do with him. It seems we were building toward him. We were blurring memoir and fiction, and we were preferring our fiction with strong memoir-like characteristics. We wanted to know more about the author. We demanded it. We wanted to know if the fiction was something that really happened to the author. We put the author on shows like Oprah and asked them to talk about how the book related to something they themselves went through. The New Yorker would run a fiction issue and all the side pieces would be not about fiction. They would be about the writer, remembering things in their lives. Story got shunted over to television, to film, to places where storytelling wasn't regarded with quizzical and even cynical glances. Storytelling can exist in places like that, on channels like Lifetime and USA, but in novels, in writing, not sure it can. Not as much anymore. In children's books, maybe, in fantasy books, we accept story. But in novels, there's a big sigh, there's an impatience, and there's a feeling of stop writing, stop making things up. Nobody believes this. Nobody believes in this. That was the course of things to our skeptical brains, and suddenly Nausgaard came and put his works out there, and we had to decide, wow, here it is. We okay with this? Do we hate it? What's the alternative? Where do we go from here? So, should you read him? Reject him? How much time in our busy lives do we give to Karl Ove Nausgaard? Mike Palindrome is here to help. But first, we're going to hear from a listener in Brazil, a friend in Brazil, she calls herself, and I agree. And she will stake out a position very different from Nausgaard without intending to. That wasn't her goal or anything, but I'm putting that on her. I'm reading her email and interpreting it in that way. It hit me at the right time to do this. So let's take a quick break, then hear from our listener, then have our conversation with Mr. Palindrome, president of the Literature Supporters Club, about the Norwegian nabob of nattering nail... Sorry. Had a full head of steam there. Let's try this again. About the Norwegian nabob of nattering, navel-gazing, and novel asterisk writing, with the asterisk containing a single question mark that somehow takes 50 pages to get through. Don't try to figure that out. Just go with it. Maybe it will make sense at some point, and maybe not. We're thinking for ourselves now, seeing what's out there and what we can take and assessing whether it's useful. We are changing our lives, not because we'd like to, not because we want to, but because we must. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Subject, Brazilian friend. Dear Jack, dropped by just to tell you how much I appreciate your podcast. I came across the show thanks to my passion for Proust. I was looking for something about him in Spotify and found History of Literature. Since then, it has been my company at lunch. I usually eat alone with you. I love your passion and your taste. Proust, Chekhov, Monroe. I'm a journalist and live in Porto Alegre, south of Brazil, close to Borges's Buenos Aires. We have great authors you should try to read. Machado de Assis, Sontag loved him. Clarice Lispector, Guimarães Rosa. Avoid Paulo Coelho, though. Best wishes from Brazil, Claudia. Well, dear Claudia, this email has given me more pleasure than you know. I, too, could use good company, and I feel as if by providing it, I'm a little less lonely, even though you and I have never met. I'm glad to hear you have a passion for Proust and Chekhov and Monroe, three in my personal pantheon, as you already know. And I do want to read those great Brazilian authors you mention, even if I don't know how to pronounce their names, all of them. My apologies, and my episode on Borges has been in the works for years. I've only touched on him so far, but a deep dive is long overdue. Best, Jack. Something else moved me about that email. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's the idea of having a friend. So simple in the title. So understated. Not, I feel like a friend. I know that seems odd. Not self-conscious like that. Not, hey, you probably hear this a lot, Jack, but I consider you a friend, even though it's a one-way dialogue. I understand those sentiments. I feel them myself. That's how I would write the email if I were writing to a podcaster. I'm not judging. But something about that subject line, Brazilian friend, as if it says, you have a friend, Jack. I am your friend. A Brazilian friend. It's a wonderful kind of thing. That subject line made me feel like weeping when I first saw it in my email inbox. Why do I have this friend? Why am I this lucky? It's because of literature. Because I've been on a great search, and my search has taken me deep into Proust and Chekhov and Monroe and so many others. And I've tried to take what I can from them, not just for knowledge, not just for intellectual pleasure, but in an effort to make sense of the world. To take the greatest thinkers, the greatest feelers, is that the word? The most emotionally astute people on the planet, the Chekhovs, the Alice Munros, and to open myself up to them, to engage with them, and to come away from it with something, anything that can help. Do I get more complicated? Yes. More cynical? Sometimes. More optimistic and hopeful? Yes, and yes. Do I grow weary of literature? Sometimes. Of life? That too. Do I feel energized and ready to take on big new projects? To squeeze life for every drop? To wrestle with darkness as well as light? To understand? To hate? To love? To live? Yes, I do. I truly do. I get all that from reading. And now I know there's a soul in Brazil, of all places, one of the few major countries I've never visited. There is a person there eating lunch and listening, and that person is on a similar quest, a similar journey to find a kind of meaning in literature, along with me and thousands of others who are listening to this podcast and millions of others who are searching without maybe having found this podcast yet, and maybe they never will, but they're part of this too. There's a person alone in Brazil who's not alone because I'm there with her. And that person is named Claudia. And that person is my friend, Brazilian friend. And I am grateful and touched and honored to know it. Oh boy, another attempt at getting to something essential. Probably went a little overboard, but that's okay. Why stay in the boat when it is leaking and on fire? Maybe we should all go overboard and take our chances in the water, even when it's deep. Especially when it's deep. Carl Ove Nausgaard. After this. Okay, joining me now is our old friend Mike Palindrome, whose own Kampf has been third, perhaps only to Adolf Hitler and our subject of today. Mike is the president of the Literature Supporters Club, and he's here to talk about Norwegian author Carl Ove Nausgaard, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, whose works include the 6 volumes of Mein Kampf, or My Struggle, and 4 books named after each of the 4 seasons. Mike, welcome back to the History of Literature podcast.
Thanks, Jack.
Do you say Ove or Ove for his middle name?
I say Ove.
Ove.
I think,
okay.
Yeah, I think Norwegians and Swedes tend to pronounce, there's no silent vowels.
Right. Okay. So I said you were here to talk about Nausgaard, and I might also have said you were here to make the case for Nausgaard. Let me just give you a little bit of where I stand on this. So, as you know, I tend to go to bed early and get up around 4 to do my podcasting, and you like to stay up late, and so we usually tape these things late at night, and I'm usually exhausted and tired, and the day is full of things. I've got a lot on my plate to do. I've got a lot of demands on my time, and here you are recommending this guy, Nausgaard, who's got hundreds to the thousands of pages of books. He's like the modern day Proust, some will say. And I think, oh boy, the idea of it just exhausts me. I have dipped my toe in the water, but do I really want to take on the project of swimming out to the island or treading water in his ocean or whatever the right metaphor is? So,
have you?
Yeah.
Have you finished? Where did you pause?
I would say pause.
I'm very optimistic.
I would say I've read about 100 pages of books 1, 2, and 3. I keep jumping around. I had to stop reading book 1, and then I heard that book 1 was sort of not his best, so I started book 2, and then another time I checked out book 3 at the library just to see if I could get into that one. Maybe it was book 4. So I've sort of I've dipped in. I've also read a bunch of his essays when they come out in, I guess, the New York Times Magazine or whatever it was that was running his essays. So I kind of have a good feel for his prose, but I've never done the full immersion, which I think is kind of, people will say, is the only way to really experience what it's like. But tell us about what the world is like. Who is he, and what is his project?
So I read My Struggle twice.
All 6 books?
Well, I read 5 books, and then I was waiting for the 6th book to come out. So while I was waiting for the 6th book, I started to reread the first 5. So I read the first 5 twice, and I'm reading the 6th book right now, slowly. I tend to read his book slowly. I think, you know, you can read it quickly. And I know a lot of people who have, and I know a lot of people who've paused and taken a year off or.
Well, he writes quickly.
He writes quickly. I think he doesn't really edit that much.
Yeah.
He has a very plain style that shifts into philosophy where it almost doesn't matter what happened before or after. There's just like this philosophical flashback or pause. But I mean, the way I think of it is the emotional accessibility and the relevance to people today. I think he's the most important writer today.
The most important writer today.
Yeah. I think, you know, and people like, I think he's opened the door for people like Rachel Cusk and, you know, Jenny Diski and Patti Smith. I mean, people are looking for Nausgaard-like writing.
Yeah.
now.
So why is that? I mean, I guess it's, if I were to speculate what you mean here, it's that he has basically stripped away a lot of the artifice of writing, and he ends up, you know, you get the sense that he's intelligent and that he's well-read, and it's not like you're just reading complete drivel. But on the other hand, it seems like the speed at which he writes and the amount of the prose that he generates allows him to lose some of the self-consciousness that you sometimes see in writers as they write and then revise and rewrite, and maybe you can kind of see their decision-making process as a writer. He takes all of that away, and so you end up, it feels like what you're reading is kind of an unfiltered look at his life and at his mind as he's experiencing life.
Yeah, I mean, I think his type of writing is actually really hard to do. And he's an incredibly charming voice to spend time with. Like in book two, he describes his daughter. He says, "Shyness appeared when Vanya was 7 months old and manifested itself through her shutting her eyes as if asleep whenever a stranger approached. She simply shut her eyes as if she was asleep." And then later, as she grows up, she tells him that she doesn't want to go to the nursery. And he feels like it's a transitional phase, so he accompanies her, and she doesn't want to play with the kids. She wants to sit on his lap. And he says, "I thought it would be best to throw her in at the deep end, just walk away from the nursery and leave her to fend for herself. But neither they, the workers at the nursery, nor my wife would hear of such brutality. So I sat on the chair in the corner of the room with Vanya on my lap, surrounded by children at play with the sun blazing outside. But the weather became gradually more autumnal as the days passed. In the break, for a snack consisting of apple and pear slices served by the staff in the yard, Vanya would only take part if we sat 10 meters away from the others. And when I agreed to that, with an apologetic smile on my face, it was no surprise for me, for this was my way of relating to other people. How had she, only 2.5 years old, managed to pick this up?"
Hmm.
I mean, there's stuff like that throughout where he is such, he's so aware of his flaws.
Mm, right.
And when he sees in other people, he sometimes attacks them. And other times he realizes that he's like that too. He goes to, there's a 50 page children's birthday party he goes to. And he just, each parent he meets, he finds them incredibly boring.
And
it's the funniest. I mean, it, you know, I think any parent can relate to this. Not that, you know, people are incredibly boring, but the setting is such that it's really hard to kind of show your best side.
Yeah.
You know, you're a parent of a young kid, you're tired. It's this kind of moronic birthday party setting.
And he comes across as really honest, that you feel like you can trust him because he's so devoted to the project of being honest that you don't feel like he's making up these characters in order to, because he as a novelist wants to make them do certain things, that he's more concerned with describing his own feelings and his own reactions to things, that you do feel like you're getting a glimpse into his actual personality and his actual, you know, his very human response to the world. But he's quirky enough and interesting enough, and he's got these weird these weird passions and irritations and all of this that it kind of keeps things surprising.
He's very, very charismatic. I mean, he says, like, "A large part of my relationship with my daughter Heidi was based on me carrying her. It was the basis of our relationship." I mean, it's like, I mean, and then he says, oh, I love this part where he says, "All my adult life, I've kept a distance from other people. It has been my way of coping because I become so incredibly close to others in my thoughts and feelings. Of course, they only have to look away dismissively for a storm to break inside me." Hmm. "That closeness naturally informs my relationship with children too. And that is what allows me to sit down and play with them. But as they lack any veneer of courtesy and decency that adults have, this also means they can freely penetrate the outer bulwark work of my personality and then wreak as much havoc as they wish on me.
Yeah, that's one of the keys to him, isn't it? That it's like sometimes when you get these long novels where people are describing the people around them and everything, you get the feeling that they're doing it because that way they can be kind of the king and they can be the master of the world and they can always get the last word and they can always, you know, that it allows them to be sort of the hero of their own story. And with him, you read it and you think, well, these people can hurt him. He's capable of being wounded. And the next person who shows up on the scene might be the one who kind of gives him the withering remark that I, as a reader, are sort of starting to feel toward this guy is like, why don't you get over yourself? Or why are you so mean to people or something like that? Like he can take those blows and he's honest about it when it pierces into him.
Yeah, I mean, he's very, very sympathetic. Even when he's committing adultery, revealing stuff about his family, his wife, his attacking friends for being like, you know, for whatever flaws they show. I mean, the struggle, you know, for people who haven't read it, his struggle is making art while being a parent. That's what it comes down to. I mean, and he says stuff like this. He says, now he has three kids. I think he has three kids in the novel, and then he has his fourth in by the time book six comes out. But he says, he's describing being at a kid's birthday party. The life around me was not meaningful. I always longed to be away from it. So the life I led was not my own. I tried to make it mine. This was my struggle because, of course, I wanted it, but I failed. The longing for something else undermined all my efforts. What was the problem? And he says that having family should make you happy, but being happy was not his goal because being happy is not meaningful. And I mean, it's a little bit of a, you know, he's setting up the novel, but I think there's a little bit of truth in that, you know, that contentment is not more than a moment and that, you know, you have to go on and do something else.
Yeah. So he's been criticized for this title, Mein Kampf, which follows Hitler's.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that?
You know, as someone who's read Mein Kampf and just finds that book to be so dull, I mean, it's almost like he's taken back those two simple words.
Mm-hmm.
I often forget that it has the same title. But, you know, again, it's different in Germany. I don't know what it's called in Germany. I guess it's called Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
The books are so funny. And the books are so much about his own neuroses and his incredible shyness. I mean, he goes to a dinner party. Book five, each book has a different setting. So book one is about his father's death. And then book two is about his breakup with his first wife, Tanya. And meeting his second wife, Linda. And then book three is about growing up with his brother and, you know, a flashback, a very long flashback to the father's strict discipline. The father was, I mean, he may have had some kind of mental illness. Like the father didn't like the sound of water in the bathroom sink going down the drain. So there's this incredible passage where his older brother, Carl Ove's older brother, Yengve, would in the morning wash his face and the water would start to drain and the father would just scream. So Yengve would stopper up the sink and leave the dirty water. And then Carl Ove, when he woke up, he would go to the sink and rather than drain and get yelled at, he would wash his face in the brother's dirty water. I mean, this is the kind of, and the fathers forbid them from cutting bread. In the morning, he would get a loaf of bread. You were not allowed to cut the bread. I mean, it was, you know, it's just an incredible portrait of this father. So book four is kind of my favorite, which is in Southern Norway is where the intelligentsia are. So if you graduate from high school in Southern Norway, you can immediately teach high school in northern Norway. And so when he was 19, he went to the north to a small fishing town, and he taught high school to 16-year-olds. And I think that is, you know, just the most entertaining of the books. Book five, just to finish this off, book five is about him attending an MFA program in Bergen, and yes, that is very entertaining also. Mm-hmm. So, and book six is about the publication of book one.
Right, and it was a huge, like a runaway bestseller, and Norway is not that big population-wise, but it was read by, I don't know, do you have a figure there? It was something like 60% of the country or something must have bought it and read it. It was like, it became almost like a gossip column or something where people were talking about who was who in the book and Nausgaard's life, and he became kind of a celebrity. So book six, I guess, takes that on and what that experience was like.
Yeah, I mean, his father's brother, Karlove's uncle. So part of Karlove's personality is this incredible shyness, and as a child, he cried incredibly easily. Like if his cracker cracked in half, he would cry. I mean, as a teenager, he would cry over nothing. Mm. So when the books were about to come out, he sent advance copies to his brother, his mother, his uncle, his first wife, shared it with his current wife. And everyone generally was flattered to be in the book, to be in the books. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's kind of a typical reaction I've heard from a lot of authors. And, you know, they kind of overlook the real portrait, and they just flattered to be in a book. But the uncle threatened a lawsuit. And so the book six is a lot about, you know, dealing with that. And, you know, the uncle accused him of making stuff up. And I mean, so that's part of the interesting thing about these books. They're categorized as fiction because, as he himself put it, because I went to hear him speak, nobody can remember all of this. Mm. It just, you know, you would naturally fill in stuff right that you couldn't remember based on, a composite of things that, you know, someone close to you has said. Yeah. And I think the thing about these books that is so hypnotic is that the details he fills in, I sometimes I feel like he can't even tell what is real and what's fake.
Mm. Well,
like the dialogue has to be fake.
Oh, because it's sort of stylized.
Yeah, but it's so, it just seems so true to each of the characters that you just feel like, well, they probably said something like that.
Well, if what he remembers is his own reaction and his own emotion when it was happening, then he just needs to invent something. You know, he probably gets into the state of mind and thinks about what he's trying to recreate, and then the words probably come to him because they would flow naturally out of his emotional state.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of hints in his writing about his own, what it means to undertake this kind of project. He says in book one, meaning requires content. Content requires time. Time requires resistance. Knowledge is distance. Knowledge is stasis. And knowledge is the enemy of meaning.
Mm.
I'm not going to say that the books are universally engaging. There are definitely moments where you just think like, wow, this is incredibly straightforward. I mean, you know, you could call it dull. I mean, James Wood.
You could call it dull.
James Wood. James
Is it Wood dull?
James Wood has my favorite quote about these books. He says, the books are not boring, but even when it's boring, I was interested.
Yeah.
You know.
And I get that there's going to be highs and lows, but part of me is like, oh, why should I read 50 pages that bore me just to get to the good stuff? Why not just reread Tolstoy or Proust or Saul Bellow?
I think it speaks more to the condition of trying to make art today than that's what I always return to, is that it really is, that's a struggle that so many people, like I have a ongoing conversation with a friend of mine who we joke, like, you know, the one generation creates all the money through finance, a finance job or something, you know, lucrative as an entrepreneurial, then the second generation, then the next generation creates art. And then the third generation is so disgusted by the fickleness and the struggle of creating art that they turn to something more stable, like a job that makes money in finance. And then the fourth generation is so bored by you know, the monotony and the conventional life that their parents led, because they were so stable that they create art. And my friend says he actually thinks it's two generations of finance and one generation of art, because art is so hard to do today that, you know, everything costs more today. I mean, the cost of living has multiplied so much compared to the reward of art.
Well, one thing that I had heard, and especially when you talk about writing, because music and things like that might be a little bit different, but you know, I had always heard that there was a there's been a decline in the use of omniscient narrators. And people have suggested that that's because we just got to be where we were less comfortable with the idea of omniscience. We were sort of, you know, it seemed like you're assuming too much about how people who come from a different station in life would think or would respond to something in order to say some universally sweeping comments. And just the whole stance of omniscience is something that we're not as comfortable with anymore. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, I've got this comparison here that a writer in The Nation made between John Updike's prose and Nausgaard's prose. And the critic in The Nation really was trying to compare Nausgaard unfavorably with Updike, but I had a different response. So he gave two passages of the first time that the reader is introduced to a young woman. And in Updike, the description is, a quote, "She is serious, a serious, small-faced animal sniffing out her new lair," end quote. And the point he was making was, that the critic was making was, we don't just see her, we see into her. You know, that gives us something about her, something about her personality. And then here's the description that Nausgaard gives in his prose. He's talking about a girl that he liked at age 11, his first serious crush, which is, you know, saturated with emotion. It's an experience you could imagine would be this sort of heightened moment in his life. And the prose here is, quote, "She wasn't very tall, and she was wearing a pink jacket, a light blue skirt, and thin white stockings. Her nose was small, her mouth large, and she had a little cleft in her chin," end quote. And so the critic was basically saying, in Updike, we don't just see the girl, we see into her, but and that Nausgaard doesn't do that. We almost see her like a photograph, and it's just sort of the plain details, and everything's on the surface, and there's no artistry to it. But what I took from that was actually paring it down kind of does something more for me in a way, because when I read, you know, Updike saying she is serious, a serious small-faced animal sniffing out her new lair, I see Updike writing that. I see his consciousness, and part of me is thinking, oh, here's John Updike coming up with a way to describe this. And when I read Nausgaard and he says she wasn't very tall and she was wearing a pink jacket, a light blue skirt, and thin white stockings, I'm not sitting there thinking about Nausgaard the writer. I'm thinking about Nausgaard the person who's encountering this. And so when I was talking before about how at one point maybe we moved away from omniscience, we no longer were comfortable with it, I'm wondering if Nausgaard is appealing to people who think we've kind of moved away from fiction in a way, or the techniques of fiction, or the artifice of it, that it's something we're all familiar with now. We've all read, you know, the prose stylus. We all kind of know how fiction works, and we all know kind of the tricks, and we know the ways that it kind of deceives us with by ref the way it describes certain things, and we're all it sort of had to double down and double down again and double down again in order to be new and interesting. And so it maybe got a little more and more clever, and you end up with this prose that just seems really far away from real life, and it seems really close to the kind of prose that writers might enjoy more than readers. And Nausgaard seems to be returning to something kind of elemental about the experience of fiction. Is that is that what you see when you read Nausgaard, or is that what it feels like when you read Nausgaard?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are all these strands that don't connect, that feels really like, I mean, I hate to say this, it feels kind of epic or profound. And I think, you know, I agree with you, like, gone are the days where you see something and you come back to it because the person lost, you know, an object, and they find it and it has meaning for them. It's not satisfying for a reader. Like, we've seen it before. We've seen like the important object. We've seen the important person, the disappearance of a person that comes back to haunt them. I mean, it doesn't, you know, we're more demanding. I mean, I really believe that people, maybe they're less readers, but the people who are reading are more serious because they're fighting to protect literature. And so, I mean, there's a scene in book, I don't even know what book it is, book five, where he goes to, I love the flashbacks. So he goes over the same scenes a couple of times, and he starts book two, he cheats on his wife. They agree to separate temporarily, but he's already has his eyes on, you know, his future wife, Linda, who's a poet. And so his first wife, Tanya, had to read about all these details in book two. She's a journalist in real life, and she was surprised and hurt by the details. So you get that's a little bit of the background. But then in book five, he returns to how we first met Tanya. And he says this, we stroll down. He and Tanya spend time with her parents for 4 days. We stroll down the narrow gravel path through the forest to the lake. This is a thing I love in his books. Like, there are forests everywhere. You just go into the forest. Where we went to a little shop. She made us coffee, and I asked her about her childhood. She told me she had had TB and spent many months in a sanitarium high above a fjord. The cure that had been to get as much sun as possible. So the women had sat in chairs on the first floor veranda and the men on the ground floor veranda because they were topless, as they say today, she said with a laugh. And then she went on to tell us what it was like when she returned home. There was a stigma attached to the illness and the tan you got at sanitariums. Everyone liked Tore. Tore is Tanya's mother. I think of the mother. Okay. We went back up and carried on with our work. A horse stuck its muzzle through the window while we were sitting there. We gave it some sugar cubes and an apple. In the evening, we sat outside drinking beer and smoking, surrounded by the roar of a waterfall from the forest, with the snow on the mountaintops on the other side shining in the glow from the setting sun. And they're just passages like this where, you know, you really feel like he could be writing, you know, about any place, but, you know, we sort of have to slow our lives down to really see what's around us. I mean, it's at once, like, very, very generic, but also incredibly grounded in this, like, I think of it as almost like a utopian culture.
Yeah. So, do you have to I mean, I don't know that you can get the right effect out of Nausgaard if you read 5 pages and see if you like it. I feel like you have to be you know.
I probably read him in like 50 page.
Yeah.
You know, segments, but I know people who've read like a book in 3 days, which I think you really get fully immersed, but I think you miss a lot of the stuff.
Okay,
right?
But I mean, he wants to. You're talking about where you keep reading it because you know you're in it and you're going to return to that world. But I guess what I mean is, do you need to slow time down in order to really immerse yourself in the experience in order to gain from it what it is that you're talking about as being the gains?
No, I mean, I think you just have to read carefully, even though so much of the details are quotidian. You have to read slowly because there are these moments where he becomes very idealistic or he becomes very angry. And
that's interesting, because maybe what you're saying is if you try to read too much at once, you'll just grow impatient with him. But if you're reading like 5 pages a night or something and looking forward to it, and then you want to go along for the ride with him as if you're kind of living a piece of his life in one piece at a time, you'll get more out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's something about reading it in order, but I've also had friends read book one and then jump to book four, which is what I was telling you, the teaching in high school in the remote north of Norway, because I think that's almost like a standalone book. And then you can read right after that the MFA years, because I think, again, that's like a little bit of a standalone book. Interestingly, a lot of people could love book two, which I don't really consider the strongest book. So.
Okay. So I've got a game prepared for you.
Okay.
The game is called Fair or Unfair. So I am going to read a quote about Nausgaard, and you tell me if the quote is fair or unfair. Okay, ready? Number one, quote, Nausgaard is Proust for stupid people, end quote. Fair or unfair?
Well, I mean, I'm obviously a big fan of Nausgaard, so I'm going to say unfair. I mean, I love Proust, but I think he is becoming less and less readable.
Yeah, well, Nausgaard is easier to read than Proust.
Yeah.
But he's maybe a little more like a blogger than the high prose of Proust. Nausgaard doesn't mind using cliches or just the sort of simple prose, I guess.
I think the difference between him and a blogger, though, is a blogger, you don't remember him. You know, you don't remember a blog post. And you'll remember Nausgaard. I think if you read all 6 books, you'll never forget certain scenes.
Right. Well, if you read 100,000 words by a blogger, you'd probably remember that too.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to. I don't think. I mean, any self-respecting blogger that can blog that much would have written a book. I mean, you look at like the Wonkette. I mean, she eventually wrote a novel. You know, every blogger. I think blogs are, it's good that people are writing, but they trail off.
Yeah.
They don't really connect to previous posts. I mean, the thing about Proust that, I mean, I loved reading Proust, but he's essentially for the rich. I mean, the more as I grow older, I mean,
he's a bit of a snob.
And reading the Proust book by his nanny, or I forget who it is, Monsieur Proust by Celeste.
Yep.
I couldn't finish it because the descriptions of his eating habits and his...
He's kind of precious.
Oh, I mean, you and the way he spent money on flowers and bellhops, and you know, he's kind of like a cheap, John. I mean, he's like, he's just trying to get laid. I mean,
Well, I have no doubt that I would have been infuriated by him if I had actually known him in real life. that I would have found it, we would have had nothing in common, and I would have found him to be, sort of intolerable.
But the
character of Marcel, though, is totally different for me.
But here's the thing about Proust, why Proust and Nausgaard can coexist. They're both wholly original.
Right.
And they are incredibly hard to compare because, to me, they really do their own thing. They're kind of in alternate universes. So,
yeah. Like we just talked about Saul Bellow, and you mentioned his best friend who had also written a novel about an experience they had both had. And you think with that best friend, well, I don't need to read this because I've read Saul Bellow's take on this, which is, 10 times better. But you don't get the feeling, well, I don't need to read Nausgaard because I've read Proust, or I don't need to read Proust because I've read Nausgaard, because they're very different. They have very different goals and very different approaches, and the style is so different. And it's really all about these two individuals, and they are very different people. So I see what you mean by coexisting.
Yeah, I mean, it's I do think everyone should read Proust, but I find that it, more and more, it's falling on deaf ears.
Well, I just got a nice email. Maybe I will read that to start the show, from a listener, a friend. She calls herself our Brazilian friend, and she found the History of Literature podcast because she was looking for someone who also enjoyed Proust, and she found our episode on Proust, and she said, now I listen to you as my lunchtime companion. It's just you and me eating lunch here. So there are still some Proustians out there. Okay, back to the game, fair or unfair. Number two, Nausgaard is, quote, the master of banality, end quote.
I think that's fair.
That's fair.
I think that that's a good moment to talk about the Seasons Quartet.
Ah, okay.
Which,
what are those about?
So when his wife was pregnant with their unborn daughter, he decided to write essays on everyday objects, one or two page essays, for her, and little letters to her. And I enjoyed trying to find stuff to enjoy in the Seasons Quartet. And when I did find something, it reminded me so much of my struggle. So I'm not sure I'm a good judge of this, but I enjoyed a lot more his little primer on Edward Munch, So Much Longing and So Little Space. I think that's a great book about, he was an art history major. That's his background. I think his eye and his knowledge of art history is exceptional. And he's actually curated a couple of exhibitions in continental Europe.
Yeah.
And he's been asked because he writes so well about art. So
that's one of the things I was going to ask you, is if you trusted his insights into anything in particular like that, because one of the things about reading big books is you kind of have to be on board with, for Proust, it's painting and cathedrals and the things that matter to him that he's going to do these kind of essays on. You kind of have to feel like either they, that it's a subject that's interesting, but also that they're kind of a reliable essayist on those topics.
I think you definitely get that. He gains your trust because he'll say stuff like, he feeds his son in the high chair, and his son kind of looks at him. He looks at his son and he's like, his son is cute, but then I'm also really bored. And there's something about that where, being a parent can be very boring. it's, there are long stretches where you're just like, what do I do with myself? Because, I'm in 3 seconds, I'm going to have to clean up something,
Yeah.
And there's a description in book six where he describes the front hall of his apartment, and that they had these shelves, and the kids, every time they find something, they don't know where to put it. They put it on the shelf. So it's become this, he calls it this coral reef of objects. And the kids freak out if you try to throw anything out. And it's just the perfect description of a lot of front halls of people's apartments with the kids. And and he then at the end of it, he says, oh, and his wife was away visiting some friends. And he's like, well, he's better. He has to clean some stuff because she's gonna like make a comment. And he says, why do relationships get ruined because of household work? And you get this, real comic, bittersweet, realization that it's really true. That,
Yeah.
there's so much arguing about, the front hall closet. I mean, it's like
But sometimes I feel like sometimes these epiphanies that he has are less, he'll also deliver epiphanies as if they're sort of momentous, but they seem like they're things like, I tell my daughter she should look both ways before crossing the street because it's better to be safe than sorry, something like that. And you just think, ugh, why am I reading this like it's a big revelation? Let me, oh,
I
go
guess
ahead.
that I mean there are moments like that, but then there are moments like his brother falls in love, he falls in love with a girl, and his brother starts to date her, and he I mean this is a the and then later, I mean he's heartbroken, but he's a teenager, but then later he introduces his brother to his wife, who is his girlfriend at the time, and his brother is clearly more charming than Karlove. And Karlove sits there all night, not talking, in his head, imagining what's going, this connection. Clearly there's a connection between his girlfriend and his brother. And he goes to the bathroom, and there's a teaser, spoiler alert, in case people decide to read it. To pause here, but he goes to the bathroom and he looks in the mirror, and there's a small piece of glass on the bathroom sink, and he starts kind of pressing it against his cheek and starts cutting his face. And the more the red comes out, he dabs it clean, and then he starts cutting his face more. And then he goes back to the bar where they're all seated, and at some point his girlfriend just starts screaming. Because she can see the blood all over his face. I mean, it's, I think
Dramatic.
every book has two or three moments like that. That is so much about,
Right.
is just how flawed he is and how flawed all of us are and the way we're trying to kind of prove that we're different from everyone else.
So when you're reading it, do you it sort of takes your breath away when you get to that passage, and then you start to realize there's going to be one of those every few hundred pages, and so you sort of are that's part of the experience, that you're on the roller coaster, and you might have long stretches where you're just riding up, and then the plummeting down is going to, it's around the corner.
There's so much in between that keeps you going that you don't feel like, oh, it's only just about those big moments. I mean, there are all these little things about like his personal life. I mean, there's so much sex in the books. Not that that should be a reason to read it, but there's so much masturbation. There's so much honesty about masturbation and sex. It's fascinating, and I think the portrait of adolescence, the adolescent male, is one of a kind.
Okay, fair or unfair? Nausgaard is brilliant but frustrating.
I mean, I think that's unfair.
You'd say he's brilliant, but you
I
don't think
don't
he's frustrating?
I don't think he's frustrating at all. I think if anything, it can make a lot of other books frustrating to read,
Interesting.
because I almost think sometimes NASCAR takes the place of conversations with real people and TV and movies, because the way you want to relax with a TV show or a movie at the end of a day, it's you can just read NASCAR, and it's more satisfying.
But and on the other hand, then you pick up something else afterwards and you think, why is this so stylized and overwritten? Why are they, why do they agonize? When you describe that passage of the like looking at the mountains in the distance and stuff, I just thought Updike would never have written a passage like that without having something new and interesting that he would insert, some adjective or some description of the shape or something that would kind of be almost like saying, this is why I'm a writer and you're not. This is how I earn my keep, is to describe this in a way that's never been described this way before.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he's a, NASCAR is a big fan of Beckett. And I think you can tell that there's a lot of, you know,
the sparseness.
I smoked a cigarette and I was out of cigarettes. I went to the store and there was,
right,
it was excrement on the street I had to bypass. And I mean, people say that Beckett's writing is a religious experience if you can get through it.
Mm-hmm.
His novels, not his plays, but his, and like, you know, this is a scene from in Nausgaard's book 5 where he says, I walked down into the town center and bought records, drank coffee in the cake shops old people frequented, where I didn't care how I looked or what impression I made or if people wondered why I was on my own. I didn't give a shit about old people and I didn't give a shit about myself either. I sat there studying the records, reading books, drinking coffee and smoking. Then I walked home, killed time, went to bed. Another day dawned. The week, and then this is the shift, because he's talking about very mundane stuff. But then he says, the weekdays were no problem. The weekends were more difficult. At 2 or 3 in the afternoon, the urge to go out and have fun like other students slowly made itself felt. At 6 or 7 o'clock, it became acute, this feeling. They were preloading all around me while I sat alone. At 8 or 9, it felt better. Soon I would be able to go to bed. And occasionally something would hold my attention, a book or my writing, to make me forget time and the situation. And the next time I checked, my watch said it could be 12, 1 or 2. That was good, for then I could sleep in longer the following morning, thereby shortening the day. I mean, he's incredibly shy. He's incredibly alone. He's basically trying to make time pass.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pathetic.
Okay. Speaking of time passing, we're coming up to the end here, but I've got 5 okay. more of these fair or unfair. Right. Let's do them rapid fire. You could just give me a fair or unfair. Quote, this wonderful book will gradually worm its way into your heart in the same way a small child does.
Fair.
Okay. This is, without a doubt, the most boring, dull, and self-absorbed book I have ever opened. After 100 pages, I realize that people who find this captivating are probably mostly millennials who believe the entire world wants to see more pictures of their friends, their dogs, and their drinks on Facebook.
I just have to counter that with a quote by Zadie Smith.
Okay.
Which is, what's notable is his ability, rare these days, to be fully present in and mindful of his own existence. Every detail is put down without apparent vanity or decoration, as if the writing and the living are happening simultaneously. Yeah. There shouldn't be anything remarkable about any of it, except for the fact that it immerses you totally. You live his life with him.
Yeah. I had that, that's similar to a note I had made when I was sort of thinking through the differences between him and someone like Updike, is that with Nausgaard, we're not thinking about him as a writer with a capital W, but almost more like a typist, someone who's recording things fast, and his observations and his feelings and his responses to the things around him are something that we can participate in. He's like a reliable narrator. What's the hearsay? Is there a hearsay exception for a excited utterance? Or, you know, it's like he doesn't have time to, it feels like he doesn't have time to lie.
I think it's, you know, back what I was saying before, I think it's incredibly hard to write like this.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an easy thing. I mean, he actually, he talks in his books about reading, I forget if he's a Swedish diarist, but there was a diarist who wrote something like 9,000 pages.
Yeah.
And Nausgaard read all of it. And I feel like that's how he got the idea of it.
Right. Well, he's got to keep digging into himself to do it in a way that's interesting. Like, it isn't just pictures of his friends and his dogs and their drinks on Facebook. He's opening up a vein here too. He's giving us his honest human response to those things, which is not easy to always do.
Yeah, I haven't found a lot of millennials who've even heard of him. I think if anything, it requires incredible patience to read. As someone told me recently, a millennial told me recently that he tried to read Mrs. Dalloway and he went to sleep. So I thought, if you can't get into Mrs. Dalloway, then there's a fundamental difference between you and me. Because that Mrs. Dalloway is just, a crazy good book, if I so.
Okay, fair or unfair? Quote, the best first person novel since Catcher in the Rye.
I think it's fair.
Yeah. Not just that it's generous, but you would agree with that. Next one. If Nausgaard really thought that time is precious, he would have a little more respect for ours. To ask us to devote 100 hours of our lives, 120 hours to reading about his own life is to make a promise that my struggle does not even try to fulfill. But we do have a choice. After all, we do not have to read the thing.
Here's my response to that. I think many people waste a lot of their lives. I mean,
They're on Facebook. They're looking at pictures of their friends and their dogs.
they're reading the newspaper. I mean, they're doing ostensibly cultural things, but it's forgettable. They drink themselves silly making conversation about what they saw online. I mean, David Foster Wallace is instructive on this point. He says that there is actually a lot of time. There's incredible amounts of time. He
People
just
just
said,
waste it.
yeah, people, so he said, people write lists instead of actually doing the thing. People make plans instead of actually meeting the person. I mean, there's, so if you can spend 100 hours reading this book, you can probably spend 10,000 hours doing really stupid shit.
Or it might be, I always attribute this to Sting. I'm sure it was told by a lot of other people, but I had heard this when I was young, and it was the first time I had ever thought about it. Someone was saying Sting was telling them they should meditate, or that he meditates every day, and someone else said, I just never, I just don't have the time for it. And he said, it'll make time. You'll be more present and alert the rest of the day, and you'll realize that you're maximizing your time doing that.
Yeah, I mean, to that person about the 100 hours, if you're not reading Nausgaard and you're reading something that you love, not to sound like a sap, but I think that I'm all in favor of that. But if you're spending that 100 hours, looking at pleated pants online for I mean, that's I think what I urge people who struggle to find time to read is go internet free for an evening. I used to say for a weekend, but I find that people look at me
They
so,
won't do it.
yeah, but they'll try it for an evening and they'll report back to me and say, wow, it felt so cool.
I've heard about New Year's resolutions that people will have apps and things that will limit your time on social media. And they'll say, like, you get 1 hour a day. And then you give the password to your spouse or your significant other or something. So you can't change it. And then you try to, you maybe, or maybe it's 90 minutes or maybe it's 45 minutes or whatever would sort of limit you enough that you're not just kind of casually doing it throughout the day and letting the minutes just slip by and something like that.
So I only look at ESPN right before I go to sleep, because it's so
You
it's
don't need
either
to do it all day. You can
it's
just
either
catch up on
sleep,
everything then.
yeah, it's sleep or ESPN.
Fair or unfair? Last one. Nausgaard is, quote, a very disturbed man, end quote.
Think that's fair. He has this, he has so many little moments where he says something like, I don't like to socialize. I don't get anything out of it. It's like, wow. He says, why do people like to socialize? You never say what you want to say, and you always agree with what people are saying. The ones who have the courage to speak, you always agree with them.
Right.
And I think, like, yeah, it's so true at the office canteen. I mean, nobody, it's so hard to break out of, to disagree. Everybody, it's like likes and,
Yeah.
whatever
It's funny.
happens,
I
just
mean,
like letting it lie.
when I read Chekhov, I think this guy was a better human being than me. He's someone I could aspire to be. And I don't get that feeling when I read Nausgaard. I think this guy had a really interesting project. He's done this for us. He's sacrificed for us. But I don't read it thinking he's got a better grip on life than I do, or he's got a greater soul than I do.
Yeah, my 14-year-old daughter asked me the other day, because she sees me reading him all the time. She said, "If you could be friends with him, would you want to be friends with Karl Ove?"
What's your answer?
Well, I say yes, but
Yeah,
I
right.
guess I'm confident in my ability to somehow force him to socialize and like me.
Okay, last question. Do you have to love literature to enjoy this? That there's a pleasure here that comes from seeing what he's up to as a novel and how you're fitting it into the history of the novel, or to recognize the differences between this and more conventional novels? Or do you think general readers can also pick it up and enjoy it?
I think you have to love literature. I think it's something like Thomas Bernhard. I mean, I was looking at Extinction the other day, because I own a copy of it, but I never read it. And it dawned on me that it's a single paragraph. It's a one paragraph book that's 200 pages. And I just thought, that is clearly a fuck you to the general reader.
Yeah,
You
right.
know, like, it's like, I'm Thomas Bernhard, who are you?
Yeah.
You
And
know?
it's maybe appealing to literature fans who will say, "Oh, it's like a high wire act, it's let's see what this novel, let's see if he can pull it off. Let's see if general readers don't care about that."
Yeah, so now that's one of Nausgaard's favorite novels.
Of course. Okay, well, let's leave things there. Mike, as always, thank you for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, there we go. Are you ready to read some Nausgaard now? I think I am. I think I might commit. Mike has persuaded me. My thanks to him, of course, for joining me. I know you hate it when he's not on the show for a while, so we'll try to have him back soon. Here's the problem. He prepares. It takes him a while. And then the scheduling, etc., etc., and finding the right night, etc., etc., etc. We have a friendship. It's nine parts literature and one part, etc. And the etc. is extremely demanding. I think the etc. is jealous of the literature, and so it pouts and whines and pleads and plots against us. Etc. is our enemy. The enemy of literature. The enemy of this podcast. And I've tried. Maybe I should kill it. Maybe I should sneak up on etc. at night while it's sleeping, sneak into its room, a pillow in my hand. There it is in bed, unsuspecting, dreaming its etc. dreams, murmuring with self-importance. And I could just take the pillow and lay it across that face. Die, etc., die. Trouble me no more. Leave me free to talk literature with my friend. Let me live unencumbered in the land of pure thought. And the sirens rise in the distance. The camera fades to black, slowly, to emphasize the futility of what I have just done. I've killed, etc. But the authorities do not want it. They do not share my goals. I have violated sacred norms. I am not an Uberman, flying above the restrictions that apply to other people. I am not beyond etc.'s reach. I haven't even killed, etc. There's always more standing by, ready to replace. It's kind of the point of the term, isn't it? It's right there in the name. It's infinite. I failed to see what murdering, etc. would do. And in the end, after I am sufficiently tortured, I will see the light. I will love, etc. The only master I am permitted, the only master I shall ever truly know, and my solace, such as it is that I am not alone. I am among the ranks of humanity, slaves to the great Lord, etc., dancing to etc.'s tune, breathing etc.'s air, subsisting on etc.'s nourishment, etc., etc., and of course, always etc. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll etc. you next etc.